This tape is a production of All Roads Ministry. This is a Joseph Calley tape entitled The Subjective Basis of Faith. Your speaker is Vin Lewis, founder and president of All Roads Ministry. But please consider, as if you would, the voice you're hearing being that of Joseph Calley. One of the many things, the title again of this tape is The Subjective Basis of Faith. One of the many things which separates the Catholic and the Protestant is the philosophical grounding with which each approaches the issue of faith. The Catholic view. To summarize the view into a very gross and perhaps unfair way, I shall divide the two views into two apparently opposing categories. Essentially, the Catholic argues that his faith is a result of the acceptance of a coherent and consistent system of doctrines. These doctrines are, reduced to their most elemental formats, a series of simple declarative sentences. For example, Blessed Mother was immaculately conceived. Jesus founded his church on the first pope, St. Peter. The sacraments have power to convey grace, etc. The Catholic sees these statements as both giving rise to and being based upon objective reality. The miracle of Fatima, or Lourdes, or Lanciano, all give convincing testimony to the validity of the Catholic belief system. The Catholic also sees his faith as an objectively real thing. By this I mean that it has some very definite limits or boundaries. Some things are in it, some things are not. The deposit of faith is not merely an interesting and traditional phrase. It reflects a reality. Some facts are, quote, deposited, unquote, into the sum total. Other facts, which may in fact be true, are officially excluded. The bank deposit of the person contains only a certain amount of money, and only certain authorized people are allowed control over it. The complexity of the faith is not in identification nor in the listing of its contents. This is the objective nature of the Catholic faith. Catholic faith is simply a matter of inclusion or exclusion according to the authority of the Church. By this, I do not mean to refer to private revelations or local customs. I refer to the universal faith of the Church, which is uniform throughout the world. To determine if a statement is or is not part of the Catholic faith is, at least conceptually, quite easy. One need only to check the official table of contents of the deposit of faith. If it is listed, then it is part. If it is not, then it is not. The Protestant view. The Protestant sees faith as a relationship. Whatever facts are included in it come out of this relationship. Thus, the basis is personal, and the result, in so much as a relationship yields a result other than itself, is the objective series of statements which are roughly equal to the Catholic listing. As this is probably very alien to a Catholic way of thinking, allow me to attempt an analogy to explain this. When a man and a woman marry and have children, they become, by definition, a family. If they do some things repeatedly, even if it is that they go to a certain place for vacation, then this becomes a fact concerning this family. The children begin to believe and trust and expect that each summer they will go to this certain place and to no other. This is simply what the family does. There are a few points which are important to understand. As few, if any, families would insist that their vacation place is the only place to vacation, so it is with the Protestant view of his faith. The preference for one place over another, or having one family tradition over another, is purely subjective. By subjective, I mean that it is ultimately governed judged, and caused by feelings and personal preference. Subjective matters, by definition, have no absolute standard of better or worse, or even good or bad. It is simply a matter of like or dislike, or, at its most extreme, more or less pleasing, even to the point of most pleasing. The Protestant would argue that his favorite vacation spot is most pleasing to him, and he might even suggest it for you. He may regret that you are missing a good time by not vacationing in the same place that he does. Yet, if you go somewhere else, this is your choice, and this does not make you a bad person. This is my first point. Recall that I said I would bring up a few points. The second one, to continue the analogy, is that this preference comes about from a relationship. The man may vacation at his spot when he is a bachelor, but when he is married, the thing becomes a family vacation and ultimately a family tradition. The traditions and the beliefs of the family, we will go to the lake this summer, grow out of the relationship. If the bachelor does not go, no one is affected but himself. However, if he fails to go when being the husband and father, then the family has placed its, quote, faith, unquote, in him, and he has disappointed them. I repeat, to the Protestant, the concept of faith is organic and subjective. It grows from relations with others and is based upon feeling and satisfaction. To attempt to contrast with the Catholic view, in order that you may understand it better, allow me the use of another analogy. The Catholic faith consists of a set amount of money in a bank account. The Protestant faith would be as if the family spent its money on an automobile. It starts out valuable, but it wears out, becomes dented, damaged, and needs to be fixed, repaired, and ultimately replaced. While the family owns it, the amount of satisfaction from it may vary significantly. It may go out of style. It may become too expensive to operate. The automobile has no fixed, unchanging value. The family will turn in one car for another without any great emotional trauma. The only thing that really matters is having a car that works. Now let me deal with how the Catholic and Protestant see each other's systems. Each party sees the faith system of the other as fatally defective. This is self-evident, obviously. If the Protestant were to see the Catholic system as the one true one, then, assuming that he would be honest and honorable, he would cease his, quote, protesting, unquote, and would return home to Rome. Likewise, if the Catholic saw the Protestant system as superior, he, if he followed his conscience as a good Catholic needs to do, he would leave Rome and become a Protestant. The fact that both camps gain adherence from the others is proof that this does happen sometimes. I need to bring in a very important caveat at this point, a digression on, quote, good faith, unquote. I mentioned the fact that people move from one religious system to another. I mentioned that this means that people become convinced that one system is true and the other false. This is the conventional view that people act in good faith. By this I mean that the person believes that he is doing a good thing by leaving one and joining the other. Of course, it is perfectly possible that the so-called good faith person who changes is doing so for reasons which are centered upon only personal advantage. A Catholic priest, because of his education and knowledge, may, once he leaves the Catholic faith, easily found his own, quote, church, unquote, and increase his income by pandering to his new flock. Catholics may leave the strict morality of the faith to embrace an easier one. Probably every Catholic knows at least one man who left the Catholic faith in order to shed his older wife and marry, with apparent, if not real, so-called benefit of clergy, when a so-called unwanted child is conceived, one can find a religion which allows abortion upon whim as well as on demand. I do not, of course, mean to imply that Schuff's shiftings of loyalty is of real faith. It is frequently, although not always, very difficult to determine if a person is functioning in so-called good faith when and if he leaves one camp and joins the other. Needless to say, as a Catholic, I accept, without qualification, the Catholic faith system as not merely superior, but as the only true one. And if I can see this, why cannot others see this? To attempt to answer this question, I necessarily arrive at certain unavoidable conclusions. I shall briefly examine them. Either I am so superior in my judgment that I can see what others cannot. I must admit, in theory, my own superiority. But this natural ability, if it were to exist, is only natural. And whatever relative defects the others may lack can certainly be compensated for by the supernatural gifts of God. St. Paul tells us that when we are weakest, then God's grace is strongest. St. Paul assures us that the naturally foolish, call them defective if you wish, are those chosen by God to understand and spread the divine message. So I must conclude that even if I can see, can understand, can appreciate what others cannot, that this makes no difference to God. God, whose power and love is beyond all human understanding, certainly can provide by free gift whatever conclusion man's mind cannot reason to. That is, whatever conclusion is beneficial for man to know. And certainly, knowing which one of the many belief systems is the one true divine one is something quite beneficial to know. Even if we reduce matters to the Protestant subjective organic view, this position is still true. If a defective, that is, not true, faith brings joy, then a true faith would be more pleasing. To use the same analogy as before, it would be better to vacation at the best spot from the very beginning. The family may enjoy its own place, but if its own place were the best spot, then they would enjoy it more. So, to the question of why I see the truth when many others do not, I must reject the answer that it is merely some innate superiority on my part. Let me deal with the next potential answer. Let me suppose that I am one of those predestined to come to the truth, and the others are predestined to be denied access to these same facts. In this scenario, some divinely erected barrier allows only certain pre-selected individuals to pass while barring the way to all others. Predestination. This is, of course, the basic theological characteristic of the so-called Reformed tradition in Protestantism. It is one of the ironies of history that it was first fabricated by Luther, yet it is never associated with his name. In general, this view is called Calvinistic. I am not interested here in giving some lengthy, detailed exposure and destruction of the Protestant Calvinist view. However, merely to examine it does, in fact, destroy it. The Bible, specifically St. Paul, solemnly assures us that God has a plan by which all men may be saved and come to a knowledge of truth. There is simply no way for the Calvinists to deal with this verse. They do not deal with this verse. They do not even trouble themselves to deny it. They simply ignore it. The God who loves us all, who created us all, does not create only some of us with the ability to be saved. God creates. God can only create good. One of the first lessons of Genesis is that everything God creates is good. Yet to hold that there exists a man who does not contain within his soul the ability to respond to God's grace and to be saved, to hold this is to hold that there exists some inherently evil man. However, as man is a creature of God, then the only way man can be inherently evil is that he was created inherently evil. And this cannot be. The Christian God, who is the one true and eternal God, is good, and all of his creation is good. Only sin is evil, and God is not the source of sin. Briefly, this means that all men may be sanctified by the grace of God so that they may come to be saved. And thus, to the answer as to why I see as true what others cannot see as true, I must also reject the view that it was so predetermined from all eternity, and that my own will has no effect in my acceptance. Essentially, I have given the reasons why I reject the more conventional answers. I have not yet given the answer, which I do accept. In many ways, this is the substance of this entire discussion. Mutual views continued. With this digression over, allow me to attempt to rephrase why Catholics, the way Catholics and Protestants judge one another. The basic views, briefly, are as follows. The Catholic sees the Protestant system as having no basis in truth. If one bases his beliefs on what he feels and what he likes, then quite literally anything goes. The Catholic is appalled at this lack of objective reality, at this lack of facts, at this lack of being able to determine what is part of a doctrinal faith and what is not. The Protestant sees the Catholic faith as having no more to do with the essence of a man than the logarithm tables at the back of a textbook. This list of things does not induce in man any kind of a relationship with Jesus. It is similar to attending the funeral of a casual acquaintance. One can relate some facts about the dead person, but friendship is no longer possible or even attempted. And the Protestant asks, you are close friends? When you are close friends, what difference does it make if you know his exact weight or his shoe size? This may be an objective fact, but it makes no real difference in the way you feel about your close friend. The elements of religion. In order to develop the main theme of this discussion, I must first establish a few preliminary positions. I am attempting to deal with the God-man relationship. I am attempting to look at the different ways the Catholic and the Protestant look at this relationship. So first, I need to explain how I see this relationship between God and man. In doing this, I shall use some analogies. I freely admit that any analogy will fail at some point. Analogies are not descriptions nor explanations. Therefore, they must fail at a certain point. Nevertheless, an analogy does point the mind in the correct direction. The use of the analogy can establish some key points and some essential facts. It simply cannot deal with all of them. But then, when dealing with God, except for the simplest statements, all attempt at description and explanation is going to fall far short of the mark. To attempt my analogy, in my attempt to outline the God-man relationship, let me deal with a range of human events and factors, which we are all familiar with. I shall try to show how these factors act on man and emphasize the degree of involvement which occurs in each instance. The four will be the force of gravity, fire, fine, as in classical music, and a modern comedy presented on the stage. Gravity. Let me now start with the least personal of these factors, gravity. Gravity is completely impersonal. It draws all bodies towards the center of the Earth. It causes all bodies which have mass to fall. Gravity has no concern as to whether this body is an airplane, a bird, an apple, or rain. They are all acted upon by the same force. Let me now introduce the human element. If a man is falling, it does not matter to gravity why he is falling or what he thinks about the event. For one thing, an Olympic diver or a skydiver, the fall is a good thing. For another man, the construction worker on a skyscraper, gravity means his death. But gravity does not care. There is no bargaining, no appeal to this law. The Bible states that the rain falls on the just and unjust, and gravity attracts the just and the unjust also with complete equality. It is perfectly impersonal. The key point here is that no matter what man does, he can change nothing. He may resist gravity or use it or ignore it. Nevertheless, it is always there, always working, always in effect, always a factor in life. In a certain sense, God is like the force of gravity. Nothing man does can change God, or God's justice, or God's love, or God's law. Man can defy God, or accept God, or employs God's laws to his benefit. But, to paraphrase the psalmist, even if I go to the top of the mountain or the bottom of the ocean, God is still there, and his eternal decrees are still in effect. Fire. Let me go to the next factor, fire. By definition, and to make things certain, let me point out that fire has three aspects. The first is heat, the second is light, the third is consumption of material. Fire is pretty much impersonal, but not to the absolute degree to which gravity works. Fire functions throughout a large degree of relationships from a human point of view. Take the characteristic of warmth. Warmth is a relative concept. All humans find some degree of warmth, namely none, to be insufficient. All humans find some degrees of warmth, such as what we would experience if we were actually to be in a fire, as too much. In between these two extremes, there are relative degrees of comfort regarding the heat from fire. What I find too warm, you might find not warm enough. The same relationships apply with the other aspects of fire. You might find the light to be too bright, why I might want more. You might rejoice over the consumption of some material, while I might regret it being reduced to ashes. Fire has another aspect which is radically different than the force of gravity. Fire is not natural. It needs certain conditions before it comes into existence. It needs oxygen, heat, and combustible material. Usually, the beginning of a fire comes about because some man wills it and then takes the necessary steps to bring it about. So fire, although completely impersonal at any particular time, is not the abstraction in action which gravity is. Fire is usually the direct result of man. Fire can be invited into the life of man. Fire can be used as a tool or as a weapon. As a weapon, it would be favored by one man and opposed by another. The very same fire can be welcomed by one man and dreaded by another. In this, it is similar to gravity. Fire is impersonal, but far less impersonal than gravity. Fire has a human aspect. Music. Let me go to the third, finer music. By this I mean the type of music written by the great composers, for example, Mozart. This does not mean that there is no good music being written today, or that all modern music is terrible, while all the so-called classical music is good. I am simply referring to that classification of music which is generally accepted as being worthwhile in its composition and worthwhile the effort to learn. It is the kind which the general opinion of man considers uplifting. To simplify matters, I shall use Mozart to represent this entire class. Although Mozart is impersonal to a degree, to a very important degree, it is not. Mozart's works are complete over and not subject to change or addition. The notes are where they are. They can simply be played. In this, Mozart is now objective. When he composed, he was doing so to please himself in a subjective manner. Mozart's works are subjective in the beginning and objective in end result. Now, they are not subject to subjective evaluations. But not really. One can play a piano piece with a violin. One can vary and interpret the music so that one version of Mozart is quite distinguishable from another. Yet it is the same work. People can prefer one conductor's version of a work to another. People can prefer the work of one musician to another, even though the notes on the paper do not change. And what causes this difference in preferences? Frequently, it is a matter of culture and taste and learning on the part of the individual. I believe we would all agree that he who has played or conducted Mozart will listen to a concert with more, or perhaps less, appreciation than the novice. He certainly will listen with more attention and expertise and with more results. The composer will hear minor errors which the non-expert will never notice. He will appreciate the expert efforts more than he who has never played an instrument. This is an ARM production of a Joseph Cally tape, The Subjective Nature of Faith. Side 2, we're dealing with the subjective and objective aspects of classical music. My point here is that the music has a great deal of objectivity to it. However, when it enters the world of man, it becomes alive only in a subjective sense. The reaction to this music comes about only because men accept it. The fact, one may argue, that man's will is the key operating factor. The more a man decides to listen, to appreciate, to work at understanding the music, the more the music will have an effect. That is why I chose the work of Mozart. Of course, it is, so to speak, pretty. However, to appreciate the full value of Mozart, it is necessary to go beyond this. It is necessary for the listener not merely to passively allow the sound to reach him. He must, if he is fully to participate in his event, use his mind as well as his ears. He must look for relationships, development, contrast, spacing, etc. I digress here for a moment. This concept, the true appreciation of art versus the mere liking by the Philistine, was the basis of the play Amadeus. I strongly suggest that you attend a performance of it. I point out that this aspect, which was the key theme, was downplayed in the movie version, so I suggest the play if at all possible. In the play, Salieri, who becomes an enemy of God, is the only one who truly and fully appreciates the genius of Mozart. He does so because he himself has tried to be such an artist and has failed. It is because he understands the difficulty in creation that he realizes the quality of Mozart's work. The remaining characters simply find the works to be nice and pretty. They cannot, because of their lack of developed knowledge, understand the accomplishment. It is this point which I am trying to get across. It is often what we bring with us which allows us to get the most out of what we experience. And what we bring with us is essentially a direct result of subjective choices. We cannot learn how to compose by some, quote, natural, unquote, event. One does not develop this ability by accident. One needs to learn the language of notes and meter to be a composer. And to do this, one needs to make an act of will to learn. And this is purely subjective. And this is what I mean by we appreciate more when we bring more with us. Knowledge and appreciation. Allow me a specific and I hope relevant example. Anyone can hear the Ave Maria. It is usually sung in the original Latin. The completely ignorant person will hear a pleasant song. This is all he will hear. The Protestant may hear a religious song of some vague sentiment. If he does not know what the words mean, he will probably enjoy it a bit more than the ignorant person. If he knows what the words mean, he may begin to rebel against the honoring of the Blessed Mother. He will be in conflict. The Protestant, traditionally, wants no songs in honor of the Blessed Mother. Before I go further, let me illustrate this with a specific example of the movie Fantasia. In this movie, the abstract nature of music is presented visually. Animators were encouraged to let their imagination react to the sound of certain compositions. One theme was the conflict between good and evil. Walt Disney contrasts good versus evil by presenting two pieces of music. The first, Night on Bald Mountain, literally has the devil call evil souls from their graves to dance and to be thrown into hell. The second is the Ave Maria. The image is one of pilgrims carrying candles through a dark forest to a cathedral. Good dispels evil. The Ave Maria is presented immediately on the heels of Night on Bald Mountain. In fact, it is the beginning of the holy song which causes the devil to retreat back into his lair and causes the evil souls to return to their own places. Goodness, by its very nature and presence, defeats evil. But how does this movie manage this without being pro-Catholic? Walt Disney was nothing if not a knowledgeable businessman. He would see nothing wrong in presenting something favorable to Catholics, who of course have money. However, he needed to avoid any offense to Protestant sensibilities, who not only have money, but there are more of them in America. And as there are more of them in America, they have more money. What Walt did was change the words from Latin to English. Actually, not really English. Not in the normal sense of the word. A woman sings songs, but sings words. But except for rare occasions, it is not possible to understand what is being said or sung. I have listened carefully a number of times, and I cannot tell you if the song refers to the Blessed Mother or not. It definitely is not the Hail Mary, which we Catholics pray. A problem is solved. Sentiment is involved. Good defeats evil. Yet the true value of the song, the true value of the prayer, is hidden by hiding its real value. And its real meaning. This is precisely what should not be done. To destroy Catholic truth by distorting it into some vague Protestant sentiment. This is not what I am advocating. Let me continue with this illustration to get across the point. If different people watched and listened to this movie, the degree of enjoyment and satisfaction would depend on how much they brought with them. The Catholic would recognize the tune and know what the song was about. The fact that he could not discern the words might not matter very much. After all, how many Catholics know Latin? The Catholic who does not know Latin may enjoy the Latin version of this song. He knows the Hail Mary. Even if he does not know which particular Latin word represents each English word. Of course, the Latin-knowing Catholic would appreciate it a bit more. The Protestant would merely see some artistic representation of some religious theme. He might like it, but no deeper theme would present itself to him. He would be like the majority of the characters in Amadeus. To them, Mozart was skilled, but not a genius. To them, his music was pretty, not magnificent. Yet it is the same music, regardless of who hears it. The object of reality does not change regardless of the subjective reaction to it. The cause may be objective, even if the result or effect is subjective. My long digression on the Ave Maria is over. My point is that the value of art, including great music, can be appreciated on different levels. It may take knowledge and commitment and effort and will to fully get the most from the event. What is true for music is also true for religion. Drama, the comedy. Let me now turn to the contemporary comedy. This is the type put on as a commercial venture. It is designed to produce money for its producers, its backers. To do this, it needs to attract a sufficient number of people willing to pay to see it. Thus, although it has the aspects of an artistic creation, it is actually a business endeavor. To do this, it needs to attract the patrons by appealing to what they already like. It confirms the patron in his tastes. It succeeds if, and only if, it does this well enough and often enough to turn a profit. It is exactly for this reason that plays, which are ongoing events, have, quote, out-of-town tryouts, unquote. They will change actors, cut scenes, alter the plot if the audience does not react the way the producers want. In a very real sense, the audience is the key deciding factor in what the play will be. In a sense, the relationship is reversed. The subjective reactions of the audience will, by affecting the creators, change the objective reality of the productions. Summary statements. Let me once again go over this range of events. The force of gravity is constant and impersonal. Gravity is beyond human control. There is no place to escape it while alive and on Earth. Fire is a force which varies in its force, and it is still impersonal. Man may run from it or draw closer to it as he decides if it is friend or foe, useful or damaging. Good music is a purely human creation. Its contents cannot be changed once fixed. However, its effect on its listeners is determined primarily by the degree of involvement that the listener brings to it. Although objectively, the music does not change, the subjective experience may be vastly different for two people who hear the same piece. And although the music remains an objective reality, it can be varied within certain limits by personal expression. The last is the play, which is designed solely to appeal to the already pre-existing subjective evaluations of the audience. It is designed merely to please and not to change anything other than the location and ownership of the money of the audience. My key point is that it would be quite literally foolish to treat music as if it were an impersonal force, as impersonal a force as is gravity. It would be foolish to hold that Mozart wrote purely to satisfy the masses. There is, in reality, a range of things, from completely objective to primarily subjective. The prudent man is he who seeks out the right mixture. This is the thrust of this discussion. How much Protestant-style subjectivity can be safely and prudently mixed with Catholic objective substance? A conclusion. What I have attempted to do with this analysis is to propose that in all human events, ranging from those of pure nature, which function whether man wills or not, to those which are of purely human creation and evaluation. They are aspects of objective reality. In other words, even the most commercial event, objective reality, as in money, cannot be excluded. In other words, every aspect of human life has an objective nature. Thus, the God-man relationship must be objective in nature. It must be based upon God's view that it is the God-created aspect of nature and not merely what man feels about it. This is, of course, self-evident to the Catholic, who holds this to be true by the very nature of his faith. This is the Catholic part of the equation. When I say this, I do not mean to imply that this can be compromised in any way. This is where we start. This is what we build upon. However, we can add to this the Protestant view, that is to say, not the Protestant doctrines, but the Protestant sense of things. What this means is to add the subjective to the objective. I repeat, to be clear, nothing can or should in any way reduce or compromise or deny any objective truth of the one true faith. I am simply saying that some of the things which the Protestant says could be of value to the Catholic. Let me try to add a Protestant flavor to Catholic truth, or perhaps let me try to suggest the following two things. That a Protestant reaction by Catholics to Catholicism could benefit Catholics. Two, by pointing out how the Protestant reaction is not alien to Catholicism, one could use this in approaching Protestants to come home to Rome, where they belong. The basics. The problem with the Protestant is that he is starting with the second step. The problem with the Catholic is that he ends with the first step. Let me make something clear before I proceed. I am not in any way criticizing Catholicism. I am most definitely criticizing Catholic individuals. Most Catholics do not live their faith in their lives. The most obvious proof of this is that few, if any of us, can immediately recognize a Catholic by what he does or the way he behaves. Few of us can distinguish between a public figure who is a Catholic and one who is a Protestant. Yet if there are radical differences between Catholic and Protestant, and there are, then the differences should be obvious, but they are not. Like the secular Jews who surprise people when it is revealed they are Jewish, Catholics have learned to pass as, quote, regular, unquote, people, that is, Protestants. This is what I am dealing with. Let me return to the Protestant problem. The Protestant builds his faith on a personal relationship with God, specifically with Jesus. From this, everything grows. The problem is this. How can one build a relationship with someone who is unknown? The answer is that one cannot. The Protestant would protest that he does know Jesus and that he is simply not letting minor doctrinal points get in the way. The Protestant is wrong. If Jesus is contained, body, blood, soul, and divinity in the Blessed Sacrament, if Jesus were born of a perpetual virgin who was immaculately conceived, then the Jesus of the Protestant is not Jesus at all, but an imposter, a fraud. And Jesus is as described. The Jesus of the Protestant is non-existent. The personal relationship between the Protestant believer and this so-called Jesus is nothing more than a subjective imagining of a sin distorted mind. No matter how much the Protestant may protest that these doctrinal matters are ancillary to the person of Jesus, the fact is this. If the Jesus of the Catholic exists, then the Jesus of the Protestant does not. And vice versa. If the Jesus of the Protestant exists, the Jesus of the Catholic does not, of course. The Protestant has made the true second person of the Blessed Trinity into one of those imaginary friends which populate our childhoods. But as St. Paul testifies to us, when we grow up, we are to put aside childish things. But although the Protestant is trying to build the second story of the house which has no foundation, the Catholic refuses to come out of the basement.
The Catholic problem. The Catholic gives dry and arid statements and thinks that this is enough. To the Catholic, he feels that the mere admission that certain truths exist is enough. Too often, it is like the professional working mother. She has her child to verify that she is a woman, and then, as soon as possible, returns to work and places her child in daycare. She is objectively a mother, but she tries subjectively to minimize the reality. Catholic fears. Too often, the Catholic sees the subjective as a fearful trap. He sees the introduction of the subjective as the road to destruction of truth, which ends in heresy. Yet the Catholic can appreciate fire without denying that it can be a destructive weapon. The Catholic can study Mozart in order to appreciate it more. He can even play variations of his music on a piano without ever feeling that this will lead to a denial of the existence of composition. He even can enter into a commercial venture, which is designed to pander to some common taste, without denying that fine things exist. The Catholic who sells hot dogs at a ball game does not deny the existence of penicillin. What am I advocating? The subjective God. Before I spell it out, let me return to one of the themes which I introduced before, the commercial play. God is all loving, all compassionate, and all powerful. God has created us in his own image. This means that God has created us to be pleased by what pleases God. The entire issue of pleasing God is problematic. I use the term in the same sense that the Bible uses it. In other words, God has presented creation to us in order to make us happy. God, who, as stated before, cannot create evil, has created us with these subjective inclinations towards him. The great saints of the church, we are all called to be great saints, all had an organic, subjective, growing, personal relationship with Jesus. We are all called to be imitators of not only Christ, but the Blessed Mother. Surely, she understood the elemental dogmas of the faith. She was central in a number of them. However, she certainly had, from the first moment of the Incarnation, an organic and subjective relationship with Jesus, always based on the reality of he who she bore within her. Notice the reference to St. John at the Last Supper. He who Jesus loved. This is a fact, a dogmatic fact, yet it is a subjective relationship. St. John is not described as the evangelist or the writer of the epistles or as the apostle who would live the longest. He is described as being subjectively loved. And from this, everything else flows. Notice the affirmation of the status of St. Peter in the Gospels. Jesus does not ask some objectively sounding doctrinal statement. He asks, "Peter, lovest thou me?" He was not asked, "Peter, do you understand the basis of pontifical authority and power which you will be receiving?" Look at the famous passage in Matthew 16. Jesus asks the apostles who people say he is. St. Peter gives the right answer. And Jesus tells him that he said the truth because God revealed it to him. But now look further. The only reason why St. Peter was able to state this doctrinal objective truth was that he gave a subjective act of will to consent to what was moving him to speak. St. Peter learned it not by objectively studying the scriptures. He was moved by God. Look at the healings. What do the blind say? They know, objectively, that they are blind. When asked by Jesus, they say, purely subjectively, "I want to see." And the subjective desire changes the objective reality. They see. When coming upon the objectively little girl, Jesus assures the apostles that what is needed is faith, which is a subjective reaction, a pure act of will, and the girl lives again. Notice the rising of Lazarus. Jesus talks to Martha about how Lazarus will live. Martha gives a doctrinal reply concerning the last judgment. Jesus asks for a personal, subjective, trusting reaction to him in addition to this truth. She gives it, and Lazarus lives again. We are all familiar with the words which verify the institution of the sacrament of penance. Jesus assures us that the subjective decision of his priest to forgive or retain will be verified objectively by heaven. And the words of consecration are not, "This is the body of Christ," the objective form, but the most subjective, "This is my body." Yet the objective reality occurs nonetheless, and Jesus becomes present. Of course, all of these lead to and or were based upon the doctrinal truth. But the point is that there was much more. The faith which held that Jesus could raise the dead, authorize men to forgive sins, etc., led to a subjective love and not merely to the admission of certain things to be true. What do we have here? We have an affirmation of the value of the Protestant approach grafted onto the Catholic truth tree. What I am advocating is that the Catholic no longer fear the subjective and no longer restrict himself merely to the facts of the faith, but also add the soul and the life of the faith to these facts. As Jesus put it to a man of faith, all is possible. And he does not mean mere affirmation of an impersonal set of statements, but he includes the subjective affirmation of the relationship which is the natural and supernatural end of that faith. Go out and grow. Grow organically, subjectively, and personally, but planted in a soil of objective dogmatic truth. It's the only way your tree will bear fruit. Thank you for listening. You may wish some additional aid on some of the issues that were raised, particularly predestination and total depravity. ARM produces several tapes on this subject, namely one called Predestination, another one called Total Depravity, and another which deals indirectly or directly with both issues is a response to the five-point Protestant. If you wish to obtain these tapes, which may help you understand further the Protestant view on these particular issues, we would suggest that you contact ARM or simply order them through the same way you ordered this tape.
Thank you very much for listening. Additional copies of this tape or any of the tapes produced by Old Roads Ministry may be obtained by contacting us at ARM 55 Palen, P-A-L-E-N, Road, number 38, Hope Well Junction, New York, 12533. Your speaker was Ben Lewis.